I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Now, yesterday and today, our theater's been jammed with newspapermen and hundreds of photographers from all over the nation, and these veterans agree with me that the city never has witnessed the excitement stirred by these youngsters from Liverpool who call themselves the Beatles. Now, tonight, you're going to twice be entertained by them. Right now and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you. Remember, I'll always be too. And then while I'm away, I'll ride home every day. And I'll send all my loving to you. I'll pretend.
It was 40 years ago on Monday that the Fab Four, John, Paul, George, and Ringo, performed live on American TV for the first time. That episode of The Ed Sullivan Show launched a musical revolution, and we're devoting today's Fresh Air to the Beatles. We'll hear from Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr and the Beatles' first drummer, Pete Best. But first, I wanted to talk about just how amazing this Ed Sullivan appearance was. You have to remember or imagine what TV was like then. There were three networks, no cable, and, because this may not be obvious to today's teenagers, no MTV. Rock and roll rarely, if ever, showed up on TV then. When it did, it was on talk or variety shows. Yet word got out fast that the Beatles were going to be on The Ed Sullivan Show. Their first single had just topped the charts in America, and young people were dying to see them perform live. Film of the Beatles had shown up on Jack Parr's Tonight Show, and even on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite. But what was shown there was a lot of girls screaming insanely, and the Beatles themselves sporting what at the time seemed like insanely long haircuts. Virtually everyone I know who's about my age claims to have seen the Beatles on The Ed Sullivan Show that night. And I believe them all. That variety hour was seen by an estimated 71 million viewers, which at the time accounted for more than 40% of the nation. That's 142 times as many people who were at Woodstock. It's also, to this day, among the most popular TV shows ever broadcast. In terms of percentage of population, only one program, the finale of MASH, scores higher than the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. Not even any Super Bowl ranks that high. Five songs were performed that night, three at the top of the show and two more near the end. Pity the poor juggling act, Wells and the Four K's, who had to follow the Fab Four and close the show. But variety was what Sullivan's program was all about. Also on that same show, it's worth noting, was Davy Jones, one of the young cast members of the musical Oliver.
I'd do anything for you, dear, anything for you, mean everything to me. I know that I'd go.
After watching the Beatles from the Wings, it was only 2 years until Jones was starring as one of the Monkees, American TV's answer to the Beatles. I also find it fascinating that in the same Sullivan show, impressionist Frank Gorshin, who later played the Riddler on TV's Batman, based his routine that night on a premise that he and the audience found equally far-fetched and amusing.
Well, it's election year, and once again, a lot of the Hollywood stars will be out campaigning for the candidates of both parties because of their interest in politics. Well, a funny thing occurred to me. What if these stars should suddenly decide to run for these offices themselves? They'd have no trouble getting votes because of their popularity. In just a short time, the stars will be running the country.
That was before Ronald Reagan, much less Arnold Schwarzenegger, ran for governor of California. How times have changed. Yet after all this time, newly issued Beatles CD collections continue to sell millions and top the charts. Their impact was and is phenomenal. And we'll examine that phenomenon in today's show. The current occupant of the Ed Sullivan Theater, where the Beatles performed 40 years ago, is David Letterman. Monday on his CBS Late Show, Letterman will note that occasion in a variety of ways. One of them will be to replay in full one of the songs the Beatles performed that night, I Wanna Hold Your Hand. Before we welcome Ringo Starr, we'll play another song from that historic Ed Sullivan show, I Saw Her Standing There.
Just 17, you know what I mean. she looked was way beyond compare. How could I dance with another? Oh, since I saw her standing there. Hey! Well, she looked at me, and I could see that before too long I'd fall in love with her.
When the Beatles played that song 40 years ago on The Ed Sullivan Show, the young man behind the drum kit was Ringo Starr. Terry spoke with him in 1995.
Can you give us a sense of what it was like early on when the Beatles' fame started getting like so extraordinary that you couldn't go places without attracting crowds? I mean,
we were young boys and it was exciting where we sort of conquered England. That was the first job, you know. Just to get down to London and get in there was heavy enough. And then we'd do the continent. You know, we used to have this, we've done Sweden, we've conquered Sweden. We've done France now, we've done Italy, you know. And then, of course, we were invited to come to America. And at that time, we were really worried because we'd had two records out here, or they were coming out. Nobody wanted them. And by chance, George came over for a holiday. He was the first one of us to come to America. And, of course, he was going into record shops saying, oh, have you got the Beatles? And they were saying, excuse me, never heard of them. So, you know, he came back saying, oh, they don't know us over there. And, of course, you know, the story goes when Capitol decided to put some money behind us to promote us and we got off the plane to do Ed Sullivan. We had a number one. I mean, you know, you can't plan things like that. This is just how it is.
Well, that first Ed Sullivan performance is one of the watershed moments in rock and roll history. What are some of your memories of
Ed Sullivan?
Of that show,
Ed, you see, I thought we come to America and it was fabulous and there was millions of people at the airport and they were lying in the streets and it was yeah, all over the place. And just my mind I have of Ed to this day, and I don't know if it's actually true, but my impression was Ed Sullivan. You know, I'm waiting for Ed to say, yeah, they are, they're all the way from England, and it's great, and they're going to be fabulous, and blah, 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 blah. And it's like Ed said, here they are, the Beatles.
Well, you probably couldn't
just
comprehend
like
the whole...
thrown to the lions. So to this day, I've always thought, God, I mean, we could have done better than that, Ed.
Well, you probably were unfamiliar with the whole Ed Sullivan phenomenon. I mean, the most
low-key,
square person.
You know, we did not know what it meant. You know, this guy just booked us on a show. We'd go anywhere for a gig.
So when girls started screaming at your performances, did you have any idea what was going on? Like, why the screaming as opposed to anything else?
It started in Liverpool.
Mm-hmm.
And just...
So you actually knew where it started?
Oh, I mean, I was caught on like wildfire all over the world.
Was it frustrating to perform in concerts where you couldn't hear what you were playing because the audience was screaming so loudly?
It got frustrating in the end. At the beginning, it was just fabulous. I mean, you know, if you can imagine you're 22, 23, and you go on stage, and all those people are just screaming at you, loving you. I mean, you know, you were making a lot of records and making good records. You know, it was everything you dreamed of. And it just built up and built up. And, of course, around about 65, you know, it started actually to get a little tiring because, you know, we were starting to make really interesting records and we couldn't perform them. And it didn't matter what we did, people were screaming anyway, so no one was listening. And because of that, we were becoming, you know, not the best musicians we would become because we could only play... You know, the actual thing, I mean, for me personally, it's very hard to to do this on radio, but I could only do the downbeat, you know, check, 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 check. I couldn't do any fills or anything because they would just disappear into the, you know, into the cosmos. So you found yourself, you know, you're just sitting there playing the track, really.
My love.
Have a favorite phase of the Beatles' recording years?
I think, well, you see, the very first record, you know, making the first records was just a thrill. I mean, it was absolutely thrilling, and listening to it on the radio, you know, we would stop the car when we'd be going to a gig somewhere, and you'd know. You know, because they didn't play them every 10 minutes. Oh, it's 7:45 on Wednesday. They're going to play your record. And so wherever we were going, we'd stop the car. We're usually in a car and listen to it. And the other thing we did, if it moved up the charts, we would always have a celebratory dinner. So if you look at Beatle photos and Beatle footage, you'd see them getting fatter and fatter and fatter as they were getting more popular because now we could afford food, you know. But and then, of course, from Rubber Soul on, you know, the record started to really get exciting. The sound, we were really getting into the sound, making sounds, making good sounds. The writing was getting better. Everything was picking up. It was really getting good. So, you know, it had a natural progression. So, you know, to say this period or that period, they're all different periods. I mean, I like the White Album. That's one of my favorites just because I felt after Sgt. Pepper, which was brilliant, but it just doesn't happen to be my favorite. The White Album, we were getting back to being a band again. And, you know, that's what the Beatles were. We were a really cool band.
Being a band as opposed to being artfully produced in the studio, is that
sure,
what you mean?
Sure, even though we did it ourselves. You know, suddenly the strings and the brass were taking the center stage around the songs instead of the group.
Ringo Starr speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. We'll hear more after this break. This is Fresh Air. Let's return to Ringo Starr. He spoke with Terry Gross in 1995.
So how did the Beatles ask you to join the band after they asked Pete Best to leave it?
Well, they didn't do it that way. You see, Pete Best was still in the band, and I was with Rory, a rock and roll band called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, Pete couldn't make the session, so they asked me to play. And we'd got to know each other in Germany because we were the two bands playing there, the Beatles and Rory Storm. So, you know, we really became friends there. And then we kept back to Liverpool, and Pete couldn't make it one day, and Brian Epstein came and said, would you play the lunchtime session? And I said, sure. And that was it. And then we went for a drink, and that was the end of the story. And then a couple of weeks later, he asked me again to play a couple of sessions, a couple of gigs. I said, sure, you know, because I just happened to have the time. And then I went away to play with Rory to a holiday camp in England, Butlin's Holiday Camp, where you go for 3 months, you play the summer there in the Rock and Calypso Hall. and we were the rock band. And Brian called me on the phone and he said, you know, would you like to join the Beatles? Well, I said, sure, I'd love to join the Beatles. And I said, when? And he said, today. And I said, well, I can't join today. That was a Wednesday in 1962. And I said, I can't play today because, you know, the band would be out of a job. We'd have to wait till Saturday because by then we could get another drummer. And that's what happened. And, you know, everybody knows the story from then on.
Well, an interesting part of the story is that you showed up for the first recording session.
Oh, yeah.
Of the Beatles. And the producer,
George Martin.
Yeah, had another drummer all picked out, because I guess he didn't know that you had been chosen to be in the band.
No, he didn't know. Well, he listened to the band with Pete Best and didn't think Pete was going to be on the session. And so he didn't know about me at all. And so he'd got this drummer, Andy White, ready, you know, a professional drummer, a session drummer. And I came down and I was just mortified. And he said, oh, we've got this real drummer here. I thought, what am I? And he didn't want to take a chance, because in those days, it wasn't like you could go in the studio and just spend your time there. You know, the session was 3 hours. You were in and out, and that was it. So Andy played on the single, and of course, then we re-recorded it, and I played on the album. And I sort of defy anyone to tell the difference. And that was it. But George Martin has apologized over and over again, because I've made him for doing this to me.
Yes, actually, I think he continues the apologies in his new book.
I think he does. Yeah. Yeah. And he did on Friday when I was with him.
Oh.
So I always remind him.
Well, what did you think the Beatles' chances were of really making it? What was your assessment of the band when you joined it?
I joined the band because they were the best band I'd heard. And that was how I played. I moved my career through Liverpool, of course, to, you know, if I could get into a better band, I would. And that's how I did it. You know, my aim was to play with good players, and that's what I did. I mean, the aim was not really to, you know, be big and famous. It was just to play with really good people.
So when you joined the band, did you have to do, you know, the Beatles haircut and the suit jacket?
Well, that's the famous line, you know, John came on the phone saying, welcome to the band, but you'll have to get your hair cut and get rid of your beard, and which I did. I didn't have much of a beard then, but I did have my hair swept back, and we had it cut so it fell forward. It was part of the image, and Brian Epstein was moving them into like this image thing too, making them wear suits and, you know, not drinking and smoking on stage. So it was all part of the deal.
Did that come easy for you? Were you comfortable with that? Or?
Oh, yeah, because I'd been in a group that had suits. You know, we, Rory, Storm and the Hurricane, we were the top band in Liverpool because we had suits. And, you know, everyone else was just in, like they are now, actually, all sort of scruffed up. But we were professionals. You know, it's all funny to think about it now, but that red suit meant so much.
Red, wow.
Red, and we had green suits, so we could change. Big doings in the 60s, I'll tell you, big doings.
No, in the Beatles, did you have to, like, figure out who you were going to be in terms of your public personality in the band? Because everybody in the band seemed to get this, you know, public persona.
Yeah, I think mine just came in naturally as Mr. Dopey. You know, it's sort of like the comic clown, you know. John had their edge. Paul was Mr. Lovable. Well, I was Mr. Lovable, but the young girls loved him. George was this silent type, and, you know, I was, hi, what's happening? And so that image, of course, especially through Hard Day's Night, is, you know, I've had to battle that since that day. Everybody thinks, oh, that's what he's like. And, of course, he's not like that at all.
Ringo Starr speaking with Terry Gross in 1995. Our celebration of the 40th anniversary of the beginning of the British invasion continues in the second part of the show with interviews with Paul McCartney and Pete Best. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Before the Beatles came to America, they were making a name for themselves playing small clubs in Germany. In 1960, the Beatles went to Hamburg as a five-member band. This included Pete Best, the drummer who preceded Ringo Starr, and Stu Sutcliffe, the bass player who quit the band in 1961, the year before he died of a brain hemorrhage. Terry spoke with Best last summer. Here's the Beatles from a German nightclub performance in 1961 with Pete Best on drums and John Lennon singing lead.
Well, look, the road goes on, so twice. Yes, I
Now, you were with the Beatles on their first German tour in 1960.
Mm-hmm.
What was that tour like?
It was a challenge. You've got to remember, we were, 17, 18-year-olds. We were supposed to be going out to Hamburg for a month, and we ended up being over there nearly close to 4 months. And, of course, when we went out there, we had no idea that we were going to be playing in Hamburg, which was the St. Pauli area of Hamburg, which was the red light entertainment district of the world at that time. We knew that Hamburg and Liverpool were ports, but there was nothing as erotic as this particular area. The clubs were great. I mean, it was wonderful from that point of view. It was an exciting place. The daunting thing was that when we actually got there, we were told that we would have to go to play six, seven nights a week. And that was where the challenge came in. But we quickly mastered ourselves to it. It was an exciting time. You know, there was lots of wine, there was lots of women, hard work. We played hard on stage and we played hard off stage as well.
Do you remember your first meeting with Brian Epstein?
Yes, we do, actually. It was, I suppose you could turn around and say, very informal. We were unaware of the fact that Brian had come down to watch us at the Cavern. But he'd watched us, he'd made a few inquiries, he realised, you know, who the Beatles were, and things must have been going through his mind. So word was passed to us after we'd played a dinner time session, which meant that we were playing for the public between 12 and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, for the office workers and kids off school. And the message was passed to us, and very informally, basically, turned around and said, I would like to see you in my office around about 2:30, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which fitted in with our timing perfectly. So we had a couple of pints in the grapes, and then off we trundled to meet Brian Epstein. And there he was in his formal attire of, you know, pinstripe suit, white shirt, polished shoes, you know, very clinical and clerical. But looking, you know, $1 million. And that was when he basically talked the deal around a little bit and said, it's a no strings a deal attached. I've always wanted to manage a rock band. You know, I might be able to help you, but, you know, the bottom line is there's no strings attached. If it doesn't work out, then you go your way and I'll go my way. And they gave us a bit of time to think it over. And we did, and we went back and I talked it over with my parents and we talked it over amongst ourselves. And I suppose you could turn around and say that, you know, the overall opinion was that, yes, he should be manager. And that's how Brian became our manager.
Well, you did a couple of auditions with Brian Epstein in the hopes of getting a recording contract. The first was for Decca Records, and that was in early January of 1962. Why don't we hear one of the originals? This is called Like Dreamers Do, and Paul McCartney sings lead on this. It's really interesting to hear him sing, because aside from a couple of places, it sounds like a pretty different style than the one he became known for. What do you think?
Well, I mean, Paul had a hell of a range, and he could deliver most songs. And, it, you know, I suppose with it being an original number, he wanted it to be delivered the way he felt it should be. And it is different, but it's very contagious, you know, the way he delivers it. It's a semi, I suppose you could turn around and say, semi-rock ballad, if there is such a thing. But it's a good song, and it was very catchy, and it caught on with the audiences all over the world.
Okay, well, let's hear Like Dreamers Do, recorded in 1962, featuring the Beatles with my guest, Pete Best, on drums.
I saw a girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love her, oh, you. You are that girl in my dreams, and so it seems that I will love you, and I waiting for your kiss, waiting for the bliss, like dreamers do. And I, oh, I'll be there, yeah, waiting for you can't just want.
Shortly thereafter, you did another audition for EMI Records.
Yeah.
And on this, you recorded four tracks, Besame Mucho, P.S. I Love You, Ask Me Why, and Love Me Do. I guess it's probably, what, the first time you recorded Love Me Do?
It was, actually, yes. We'd played it many, many times. We improvised it in Germany, and that was when we first heard that we got the recording contract. And Brian Epstein, I'm talking now about April 62 when we opened the Star Club, it was very much a case of Brian telegraphed us and turned around and said, congratulations, you got the recording contract, start rehearsing your own material. And that was when we tried that out on the German audiences. We tried different formats. We tried a guitar lick in there, as opposed to the world-famous harmonica, which, you know, the world knows today. We weren't happy with that. The arrangement, we changed that around a little bit. Then we introduced the harmonica into it because we wanted to make it a little bit more haunting. And there was a change of beat in there because what was happening in those days, change of drum pattern, and a number was very commercial. You didn't hear it too many times. So consequently, here on my particular version, which was the one that we played to the audiences of, in Germany and Liverpool prior to the recording, has a change of beat in it. And it was, you know, they liked that change of beat, and we thought that it worked well.
On this audition version of Love Me Do, it's slower than the version that was actually released. And the harmonies are a little off. It's not very polished sounding.
Well, it wasn't. You've got to remember that wasn't a finished. You know, it wasn't
exactly
meant to be finished.
Yeah.
It was supposed to, you know, go. We were supposed to go back. It was just to give George Martin an idea of the type of material that we could write. The whole essence of it, that we were supposed to go back and put the finishing touches to it. So what, you know, the people hear, it's a slower version. It's a little bit more country orientated. If you listen to the harmonica, it's a little bit more haunting. And I think there's a little bit of sorrow in it because we were reflecting the fact that Stu, you know, had died a couple of days beforehand. We were still under that particular, you know, tragedy. That was still hanging over us. And I think it was reflected in the music as well.
Okay, here's the Beatles, recorded in 1962, with my guest Pete Best on drums. What was it like for you to watch the Beatles become the most famous band in the world, and you had been with them and weren't any longer?
Interesting, if I could put it that way, and mystifying as well. I suppose the heartache came when the first record, Love Me Do, went into the charts. The mercurial rise and the, you know, watching them become the, you know, the biggest phenomena in the music industry was something which I don't think anyone expected. So that was like total fantasy. But the heartache for me was initially, you know, with Love Me Do, because that was the belief that we had in the band that we could break through into the English charts. And lo and behold, with their first record, you know, the first release on a major English label, you know, that was the success we'd believed in. So the rest of it, you know, was a little bit pipe dream.
Pete Best, speaking to Terry Gross in September 2003. Next up, Paul. This is Fresh Air.